Welcome to Political Rewind on a what's been a difficult news day, certainly in Washington, but one that's had repercussions across the country and here in Georgia as well. We're going to talk a bit about that. Then we're going to talk 6th District and a little bit about Jeff Sessions yesterday and where this whole investigation in the terms of Russian interference with the election is headed. Joining me is, as he is always, on Wednesday afternoons, Greg Bluestein, a political reporter at the AJC. Busy time for you, Greg.
Yeah, and we're about to go around the table and say nice things about you, so...
Oh, you are?
A la cabinet style.
Oh, I hope you do. Kerwin Swint is back with us. He's a political science professor at Kennesaw State University. Kerwin, you told us before the show started, you are getting... Everybody wants to talk to you from the media around the country about the 6th District these days.
Yeah, they think I know something about the 6th. I don't know. Yeah.
I think you do, and we'll get a chance to talk to you about it in just a little while. If you were here on Monday and heard us, we mentioned Tamar Hallerman from the Washington Bureau of the AJC would be with us. Tamar is stuck in her office crashing, she says, on a lot of deadlines, so she won't be with us. If you're a Tamar fan, I'm sorry. We'll have her back some other time. But in the meantime, Lisa Clark, our Political Rewind producer, ever since the news broke this morning of the shooting at the Republican congressional baseball practice, Lisa's been monitoring the wires, watching the cable news networks. And so Lisa's going to be with us for the first little bit of the show to talk about that. Thanks for doing this, Lisa.
Happy to be of service, Bill.
So, Lisa, let's take this in some sort of a basic order. I think people know the basic details
exactly
of what happened this morning.
Republicans were warming up or practicing for this weekend's baseball game between the Dems and the Republicans, and a shooter showed up. And I don't know if we want to start with the Rand Paul account.
I think that's a good idea. Rand Paul was on a number of cable shows this morning to talk about how he was there.
He was there, warming up in the batting cage.
Yes. And, of course, Steve Scalise from Louisiana, a Republican from Louisiana, and a member of the leadership was the one member who was wounded. We'll update him in just a minute. But Rand Paul pretty quickly got an opportunity to talk about what he saw. Here's what he said.
But then after the first shot, then there was a rapid succession of shots, you know, 5 or 10 shots. So I'm outside the perimeter. I'm on the right field line, and the batting cage is outside the field. There's about a 10-foot fence between me and the field. And in the field, I see Representative Scalise is shot but moving, and he's trying to drag himself through the dirt out into the outfield. There are two staffers in right field, only about 10 feet from me, but there's about a 20-foot fence separating me from them, and they were laying down, but then I'm seeing the shots hitting the dirt around them, and they're trying to make a difficult decision. Do we lay here, stay low, and hope he doesn't hit us, and this is a difficult decision, or does the shooter just advance and come closer and shoot you? And so you have to make a decision at some point whether to stay or run. And so one of the staffers scrambled up over the fence. It was probably, like I say, a 15, 20-foot tall fence. He did it in about 2 seconds. I don't think I could have done that. So I'm on the outside of the fence, and he and I are hiding behind a tree. But the gunshots are landing in the dirt in the outfield and around us.
So we let that play a bit because, you know, you read a headline, and it's sometimes not easy to humanize what's happened. And I think Rand Paul really did that for us. Were you all struck by his description of how that unfolded and what it must have been like?
Definitely.
I mean, field.
It describing the shots hitting the ground and not knowing what side of the tree to stand on. They couldn't really tell where the shots were coming from initially.
It brings me back to when I was playing baseball. I mean, just I could see myself in his shoes.
Mm-hmm. It's the last thing you expect. You're out there to practice for a ball game, and you know, all of a sudden, all hell breaks loose.
There was some question. In fact, Newt Gingrich, who we're going to hear from him in a little bit, but Newt was on, along with Senator David Perdue, was on Fox Business News when this happened. Newt, who we'll hear another comment from, Newt said he wanted to get to the bottom of how the shooter. By the way, the shooter's name
is
Lisa?
James T. Hodgkinson, and he's originally from Illinois, 66 years old. He has apparently been in the Alexandria area for at least 5 weeks. He's pretty well known to people in his area. He writes some incendiary letters to the editor. He's a virulent anti-Trump person, and as a matter of fact, is part of a Facebook group, was part of a Facebook group called Terminate the Republican Party. Described as opinionated but never radical by people who know him.
So what? Yeah, thank you for that. Newt said, "I want to find out, get to the bottom of how he knew that there was a baseball practice." But it is what we've learned today is that that's where the Republican, their big game, the congressional baseball game, is tomorrow night. It's a charity event, and that's where the Republicans have been practicing. So it's not a question of someone apparently somehow leaking confidential scheduling information.
Right. Well, there's a YWCA right near there, and apparently this Hodgkinson fellow had been going to the Y, so he might have picked that up.
Should we hear what the president had to say,
Absolutely.
Lisa? He made a statement a few hours after the event.
Absolutely.
Everyone on that field is a public servant. Our courageous police, our congressional aides, who work so tirelessly behind the scenes with enormous devotion, and our dedicated members of Congress who represent our people. We may have our differences, but we do well in times like these to remember that everyone who serves in our nation's capital is here because, above all, they love our country.
All right, so President Trump weighed in.
It's worth noting that because Steve Scalise is the majority whip, part of House leadership, he had two bodyguards with him. And folks have said that had he not, that the carnage could have been much more devastating. As it was, five people injured. The shooter died apparently at the hospital shortly after. And I think everyone who was assaulted today, who was shot, has been in and out of surgery now. There was a lobbyist named Matt Micah, who works with Tyson Foods. He was on the field, and he appears to be the most seriously injured. But from the Twitter feeds I've checked, he is out of surgery. He's on a breathing machine right now. And I guess he's in critical but stable condition.
All right. So Kerwin and Greg, let me bring you into the conversation in a second here. Because, as I said, David Perdue and Newt Gingrich were both scheduled and were on the air at Fox Business News when the story broke. And they each had something to say immediately about this and what it implies about how members of Congress ought to be protected. And I think it's worth listening first to David Perdue and hear how he responded to this.
I'm horrified. This is a shock to all of us here this morning. But it just, I think, accentuates we've got to find a balance between being available and accessible to our constituents and the public and yet providing security for our leaders. I mean, Steve was the number three guy in our Republican caucus in the House. I mean, this is serious.
All right, so that's David Perdue. A little bit later, this is what Newt Gingrich said about security for elected officials.
In a free society, if you're going to have representative government, everybody below the president and the vice president is going to be at some risk because otherwise you can't reach them. I mean, you start sealing people off, they become an aristocracy of security. So, yes, it's a little frightening. Yes, it's a little dangerous. But I think it's also the price of a free society. And I would hope that we wouldn't rush to tighten things up even more, which is one of our unfortunate habits after each of these incidents.
So, Kerwin, Greg, two very different takes on this. Want to respond?
Yeah, I mean, I guess Speaker Gingrich was kind of saying almost it kind of comes with the territory. And there is a debate about whether or not rank and file members of Congress should have security details. In places like Georgia, you already see the governor, the lieutenant governor, the mayor of Atlanta, you know, some high-profile politicians have security details. But whenever you do have a security detail, it is one extra layer between them and the public.
Yeah, it's an obvious question to ask. But like Gingrich was saying, you're going to wall off these representatives from everyday events, their constituents, to the point where they would be a special class more than they already are. Then you're going to run into a practical reality of paying for all that security. It's going to be insurmountable.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see when they play this baseball game tomorrow night. Well, the kind of security at an event like that, I suspect it's going to be pretty intense around that field.
Yeah, and the other interesting thing is the Braves actually are playing the Nationals in Nationals Park tonight, is at the last game of the series, and then tomorrow they're playing the congressional baseball game at the same park, Nationals Park. So it'll be a much more meaningful baseball game tonight, I think, than any other game, especially the way the Braves are playing this season.
Lisa, is there, so you've been looking at Facebook posts for the shooter.
Exactly.
What's going on there?
Well, I think they've finally taken down his Facebook page, which is a good thing because it has become sort of a place for people with very extreme partisan reactions to voice their opinions and not very respectably. And in a situation like this, when you're dealing with someone you don't know, did Hodgkinson have other issues going on, mental things? We don't know. We do know that he was a volunteer for the Bernie Sanders campaign. People are making a lot of hay out of that. And I think we have a soundbite from Sanders who responded to that today on the floor.
Yeah, let's listen to what Sanders said.
I am sickened by this despicable act. And let me be as clear as I can be. Violence of any kind is unacceptable in our society, and I condemn this action in the strongest possible terms.
That said, there is already so much politicization, did I say that right, of this event. And things have been seen on Twitter. Things have been seen on Facebook. Some people are saying, well, Hodgkinson liked Rachel Maddow's show, so she's to blame for constant hate-mongering. Representative Chris Collins of New York has blamed Democrats for the current tone and anger towards President Trump and said, I only hope they tone down the rhetoric. It's been outrageous, the finger-pointing, the tone and the angst. It's an opportunity for people who are strongly partisan to kind of like get in a dig at the other side right now,
and
which is an unfortunate thing.
I apologize for interrupting. And Greg, you talked to the governor about a number of matters just this morning, right, including this, and he urged what?
He said this should not be politicized. His quote was, and it kind of goes to just what you were just saying. He said, we don't know what the motivations are yet, but even if they are political, we all need to understand that we sometimes need to lower the rhetoric in political circles and in the media that does not raise the fears and apprehensions of people that would lead them to do things like that. And then, you know, you take a sort of introspective look at what we as reporters do, and we use the words slam and assail and hit and struck
attack.
And attack and things like that. And honestly, it's because that's what they are. An attack ad is an attack ad. It's pointed for a reason. But we use these sort of combative terms so often that it might not help the debate either.
As I said, Tamar Hallerman couldn't be with us, but she shared with us audio. She had interviewed Barry Loudermilk. Representative Loudermilk was on the field. Excuse me. He was the only Georgia representative who was present when the shooting took place. He says he was standing near home plate as the baseball team kicked off its final practice. And here's the quote. The shooter walked up to the fence and started shooting at us, so we all started running. That's when House Majority Whip Steve Scalise was hit as he was turning to go. I kept trying to get to him, but every time I tried, the perpetrator had moved over to our side and would start shooting in that direction, Loudermilk said. He had us pinned down. So a very frightening event for all of concern this morning, Kerwin.
Well, it is. And, you know, it's tempting to try and use this for partisan gain. But, you know, we've been here before. Every time there's a shooting, it seems like some politician blames the other side or tries to make some you know, political gain out of it. But I think the governor's right. We do need to calm on all sides and try and quit making our opponents our enemies.
Okay, so we're going to take a break. And as I said to all of you before we started the show, I want to build my own wall right here. That event was awful, horrifying. We have an injured congressman. We have apparently a severely injured
lobbyist
up on the Hill. And yet, as we sort of talked briefly about, there already are attempts to politicize this. So the wall is this. That's what happened. That's reality. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we are going to talk about how an event like this impacts on politics that we're dealing with right here in Georgia as well as across the country. Lisa Clark, thank you so much. You did a great job.
Thank you.
Bringing all this together today.
I was happy to be of service today. I know you had a busy day, so it was good to be able to contribute.
All right. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Nina Totenberg. Are you someone who talks about how great public radio is, but you're still not a donor? Rather than wait for the next pledge drive, you can support the programs you love by donating that unwanted vehicle. It's served you well over the years and can still get you around town, but let's face it, it's just taking up space. Donate it today. It could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station, and you could get a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
You know, we usually have great musical beds for our Give Us Your Car promos. I don't know. That one, not one of the most. It was fine. Let's do better, whoever puts those together. You're back on Political Rewind. Kerwin Swint from Kennesaw State University joins us, and so does Greg Bluestein from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. All right. There were political responses to this, even right here in the district. Greg, one of the things that happened is it turns out, and it was, I don't know who sent it around, but it was sent around, that the shooter had posted on his Facebook page his support of John Ossoff, and essentially he had posted the story about Karen Handel and livable wages.
Yeah, he had posted at least two things about our sixth district race, which just shows you how nationalized it has got that someone in Illinois who is a Bernie Sanders supporter was posting about a congressional race in suburban Atlanta. But it looks like a Facebook user with his name that has been identified as the shooter posted something right before the April 18th vote saying, go and vote for John Ossoff. And then again, more recently, called Karen Handel a name we can't use on the radio and said that she wants people to work for slave wages and attacked her for the livable wage comment she made in last Tuesday's debate. Ossoff has said what he has done is horrible, that there are no links between him and the campaign other than those Facebook posts. There's no donations. There's nothing else. He obviously never met the man. And Handel has also condemned, obviously, what happened this morning. Both campaigns, Ossoff had one event at noon, and I don't think he's having any other public events today. And I think Handel's not doing any public campaigning today either out of respect for the victims of the shootings this morning.
Kerwin, there's no advantage. Ossoff clearly in talking to Greg and saying, I condemn this guy. That's what he needed to do. And there's certainly no advantage for the Handel campaign to try to make that connection that the Facebook post suggests.
No, not at all. I mean, all you can do in a situation like that is express profound sadness and support for the families. But it shows you the extent to which the 6th District race has become a national campaign. It is being followed nationally, and especially in New York and Washington, by the media. And what can happen when somebody who is probably emotionally unstable is doing their own political analysis and acting on it?
Yeah, it does strike me that that's just a situation you want to avoid. The question is, can it have an impact, Greg?
I don't know. It deprives, I guess, the candidates won't be getting any more media attention tonight or today, and maybe tomorrow, depends on how long they take a sabbatical from campaigning. I don't think it'll be that long. But it also, I've heard from a couple of Republicans who say it could theoretically put Ossoff in a bind if he's being asked about his stance on guns, if that gets a little bit more attention. And he has not been a very vocal supporter of gun control, which can put him at odds with some of the left-leaning members of the Democratic caucus. I think maybe even some Republican surrogates might be putting out, may in the next few days be highlighting the fact that this guy supported Ossoff.
Yeah, I think both sides, Ossoff and Handel, have to tread very carefully around this because they don't want to be seen as taking advantage of a crisis like this. And yet, they're trying to win a campaign next Tuesday. And so, at some point, it may be possible for them to make a statement of some kind. But I don't think this event by itself necessarily affects the outcome next Tuesday.
You know, when I listened to the Rand Paul sound again, his describing the scene, what it was like, Greg, so often when there are incidents, shootings of this nature, it comes right back to Washington because one side argues for more gun safety laws. The other side says, no, this is guns. It's not guns. It's people, all this sort of thing. And I couldn't help but think now members of Congress are in the middle of understanding what this is like. But there's no reason in the world to think that an incident like this will trigger a new evaluation of whether they need to do something on the Hill, I would think.
No, I mean, you look at the last time something like this happened with Gabby Giffords in Tucson in southern Arizona. And yes, she ended up starting a national gun control movement, but it doesn't have too many successes under its belt yet. Obama signed a few executive orders and executive actions to try to limit some gun sales, but no legislation certainly passed. And I don't think anything will come of it this time either.
And if you look at John Ossoff's campaign, he's doing best he can to be an independent and trying to be as neutral as possible. The last thing he needs is more emphasis on issues like gun control.
You can tweet us, of course, at PoliticsGPB. People are already doing that. Khalid, who tweets at the handle Khalid Care, says, if GOP shooter was Muslim, we'd be raiding mosques. But white men are never terrorists. They're just crazy. So I get the sentiment there, and I understand that there are what happens, the inflammation. But we have had white shooters in the past, and they have been dramatic, and the response has been. I mean, do you think Khalid is making an important point here, or is he missing the point?
I mean, you could go either way. I mean, I think most terrorists are crazy anyway. I mean, there's a certain emotional instability there, even if it's a religious terrorist. But most of our shooters, if you look at the history, have been white. They have been white males over a certain age with a certain similar pattern.
But I think, he has a point. If this shooter was Muslim, I think we'd be talking about a terror attack right
yeah,
now.
Probably.
Yeah,
probably.
And we're not. I don't really see the words terror attack out there. The FBI is investigating, but it hasn't gone much.
Unless he's part of some organization that we don't know about, then that could change it.
All right. I want to take this back to the national level in terms of how this is being played out politically. Let's talk on the show on Monday, and many of you are following this independent of us. There's been a lot of controversy over a production by the Public Theater, Shakespeare in the Park, of Julius Caesar that they're mounting in Central Park this summer. Midway through the play Julius Caesar by William Shakespeare, Shakespeare resets the death of Caesar, who was stabbed viciously by the members of the Roman Senate. That happens midway through the play. The rest of the play actually deals with all of the things that go wrong and why this assassination, political assassination, was wrongheaded and sends everybody who conspired spiraling downward. Nevertheless, because Oscar Eustace and the director, who's the artistic director and the director of this production, created the Caesar character to resemble Donald Trump, there has been an outcry of people who say you're staging the assassination of a president on stage. Have I got that right so far,
yeah,
Greg?
Yeah, and not only that, the actor resembles Donald Trump. He's wearing a suit. He's wearing a tie. He's kind of portly.
Isn't there a Melania character as well on stage?
And the thing is, by the way, we didn't talk about this in detail on Monday, but other theater companies over the years have also taken actual political figures who are in the news at any given time and put them in the Caesar role. The Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis, one of the most respected regional theaters, did a production of Julius Caesar where they portrayed him much like a Barack Obama figure. But here's the point. Fine, I get why there's outrage. It's a brutal scene. And so I understand the people who are critics. Donald Trump Jr. this morning sent out a link to a tweet from a conservative commentator who essentially lays the shooting in Washington at the feet of the Public Theater. That seems to me to be something that we all have good reason to be really concerned about.
Yeah, I mean, I've read about the play in New York, and artistic freedom is a reality, but I think there are limits to it in situations like this. But yet again, it's wrong to try on either side to use this against someone and for political gain. It's just not the right strike to note to strike.
All right. I just wanted to mention that because I think in the days ahead, Greg, we're likely to see more politicization of this particular incident. And I hope not, frankly.
I mean, yeah. I mean, and you saw what happened in England with the terror strikes in Manchester and in London, and in immediate tweets from the president and other supporters saying this is a reason why we need the quote-unquote travel ban. So there's a long history of using incidents like this, rightly or wrongly, to emphasize a crackdown on some public policy that you want to support.
All right, let's move beyond that, and let's talk about the nuts and bolts of the 6th District race, less than a week out. Next Wednesday, Greg, is...
It gave me chills in the promo saying by this time next
yeah,
week,
next Wednesday,
we'll have our congressman elect.
I know you're going to be up all night Tuesday night, yeah. But we're counting that you'll be here next Wednesday,
here.
And we'll be able to talk about who wins that race. Early voting continues to be extraordinary, doesn't it?
It's astounding. It's more than half of the entire turnout for the April 18th race already.
Amazing.
And it has far surpassed the early voting totals for the April 18th, you know, alone. So, and there's a debate out there. We're looking like we're going to well exceed 200,000 votes in this race, which is going to be well over the April 18th numbers. Is that good for Republicans or bad for Republicans? Usually you'd think that higher turnout benefits Democrats, but in such a conservative-leaning district, it could end up helping Republicans.
Well, it could. I mean, the Republicans have a numerical edge in the 6th, which is always, you know, why we've been saying that the Republicans should win. But it may be, if you're Karen Handel, you're certainly hoping that all these people voting are the ones who didn't vote on April 18th, and that should help your Republican base turnout, which is what she needs.
Yeah, Greg, you said that's you're both really interesting right here. How much has I don't have this figure, and maybe you do. How much has Ossoff outspent Handel on this race?
Oh, he's raised more than $23 million
right.
overall. She's raised, I think it's something about $5 or $6 yeah. million dollars yeah. overall.
Okay.
So huge margins. And he's already spent. She actually had more cash on hand than him, which was astounding.
Yeah.
She had about $1.5 million. He had about $1 million. So he's spent $22 million plus over the last, over the last 6 months. But really, a lot of that money was spent, $15 million or so was spent in the last 2 months alone.
Right. TV and radio.
Tamar Hallerman had a piece, I think it was Tamar's on byline, not yours, on how Ossoff has been spending that money.
Mm-hmm. Largely on, obviously, TV ads. They've put in $7 million plus, I think it's now at maybe $8 million, since April 18th, just for the June 20th TV ads. There are something like 170 people on the payroll. Not all of them are full-time staffers, but he's paid 170 staffers, which shows you the extent of his ground game.
That's part of his budget right there.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, just the amount of money he spent on payroll would be enough for an entire typical congressional campaign.
Yeah.
While Handel, by contrast, has maybe a dozen or so staffers who are listed on the payroll. She probably has more staffers than that, but who are listed in the campaign expenses. So it's astounding, really eye-popping, how much money is being spent on this race that now well tops $40 million and is easily the most expensive U.S. House contest in the nation's history.
Another astounding part of it is just how much money comes from outside of Georgia. I mean, we knew that particularly John Ossoff is getting a lot of money from outside Georgia, but it's 98%, or it's incredibly high.
Yeah, it depends on how you look at it. But exactly, there's only a couple percentage points there within the state of Georgia, and Handel too.
Yeah, Handel too. That's
not
right.
as high, but Handel is about roughly about 2/3, 3/4 of her money is coming from out of state. Both of them are going to the well outside of the state. She's had fundraisers in Washington with Republican leaders. He's had all sorts of donations. What he's likely to say is, look at his donations. The average is less than $21. But she'll still say most of your donations are coming from places like California, New Jersey, New York, liberal bastions. You're getting more money from California, New York, and New Jersey than you are from Georgia.
All right. But, okay, and one of the reasons I wanted to talk about the money gap, and I really, all those things you both fleshed out are really interesting to me. But if John Ossoff loses this race, after outspending her by that vast sum, if in fact, Kerwin, this district returns to its roots, it is a Republican district, it is a devastating defeat for not just John Ossoff, but the Democratic Party.
It is, but they'll spin it. I mean, you know, the Republicans are going to say, okay, they're 0 for 3, you know, having lost in Kentucky and Montana. And Ossoff and National Democrats spent literally tens of millions of dollars, and they still lost. But the Democrats will say, well, yeah, but look how close he came. You know, what if he gets 48, 49% of the votes? They're all of a sudden going to declare this district purple. They're going to say, okay, now it's a competitive district, just like a lot of those districts next year are going to be competitive. So they'll spin it in their favor.
But it took almost 25, more than 20, by the end of this, it'll be more than $25 million he's raised to do that in an all-out war between the two parties. I hate to use the combative terms we were just criticizing earlier, but it really is this kind of proxy fight between the two parties, and there won't be nearly this in November 2018, even if it's Ossoff who wins, it won't be nearly this expensive because there'll be hundreds of other races all over the country to divide the American public's attention. In this case, it's really, other than, you know, those special elections you just mentioned in Kansas and Montana, this is kind of it.
I noticed, and I see a lot more Ossoff ads and Handle ads, no surprise, but Greg, you watch all of it. I find it fascinating that not the PAC ads, but the campaign-sponsored and produced ads that Ossoff has been running now for a couple weeks are all positive ads. Him looking into the camera, saying, here's what I plan to do as your member of Congress. Now, I don't see Handle produced spots as much as you may. Is she doing positive? I saw one Handle spot that I thought was fascinating because the first shot showed her in a very positive interaction with an older woman. Kind of, they're looking at each other. They really like each other. And bam, it went right to an attack on Ossoff. And I thought that was an interesting balance. But how's this playing out?
Yeah, both of them have released, he's released his closing ad. I'm not sure if this is her closing ad, but they both released ads yesterday. His was exactly what you said. It was him literally returning to the kitchen table to talk about kitchen table economics. There's no music in the background. It's just him looking at the camera. Spot on. I don't think he mentions Karen Handel at all. He talks about cutting the budget, about ending wasteful spending, this very sort of politically neutral comments that he's made throughout the campaign about slashing $600 billion from the budget. And the very end of it, the sort of materializes the name John Ossoff for Congress. No mention of political party whatsoever. Handel's latest spot was exactly what you said. It was her, I think she was talking to some voter at the beginning of it, and then it just pivoted to her looking directly at the camera too, talking about her history and background in the district, and then slamming John Ossoff as someone who is a out of the district liberal.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it's a strategy. If you look at the debates, for example, Handel was the aggressor for the most part in those debates, and I think she had to be. You know, from her standpoint, she needs to knock down Ossoff in the eyes of the voters there. And,
well, especially because their poll shows that 13% of the Republican, when I say there, the AJC poll shows 13% of Republican voters say they're going to vote for Ossoff. So go ahead.
Well, yeah, and so she's got to knock down those numbers as much as she can. But you pointed out that's the Achilles heel here. I mean, Karen Handel's worst nightmare are these Republicans in the district, you know, some who are moderate, you know, maybe, you know, imagine suburban women who want to send a message, you know, that if she loses, that's what's going to beat her.
And that's exactly, he has to win a decent slice, 10% or so, maybe 15% of the Republican electorate to win.
Yeah.
And there is such a huge gender gap. Even though she's running to be the first female Republican congresswoman from Georgia, he's not just in the AJC poll, but in every other, pretty much every poll, he's leading among women by double digits, and she's leading among men by double digits. And that's the same thing. We're seeing that same dynamic sort of, you know, in other races, too. It's not just unique to this congressional district, but it shows you where he thinks his strengths are. And I think he'll continue to talk about Komen, Planned Parenthood, and those issues these final few days as well.
Is Ossoff easy to get a handle on these days? Can you track his activity? Are they putting out a public schedule?
Yeah, he's been, there's obviously trackers that they're worried about, and we can talk a little bit more about that as well. But they've been putting out schedules pretty much every night for the next day. He's had at least an event a day this week. Some days, I think it was Monday, he had two or three or four.
Yeah.
And Handel's had a few more public events than usual of late, too. And there was one that we were able to catch. There's a couple that we were able to catch right yesterday as well.
I haven't been able to get to. I'm a 6th district voter. Call me, John.
Come on the show.
Come to my house.
What do you mean by trackers and why you? I mean, explain to listeners. I think everybody knows.
Yeah.
But tell us who trackers are.
So both parties and sometimes campaigns and sometimes outside groups as well have trackers assigned to follow a candidate's every move in the hopes of catching them in an embarrassing gaffe or miscue or even just a phrase that they can exploit. And trackers have been on John Ossoff and Karen Handel since at least April 18th, I think for John Ossoff even before then. And yesterday at one of the events with Karen Handel, a Washington Post reporter asked her, is this race getting to be too much with the trackers and with the ads and with all the attention? And there was a tracker engaged in this very elaborate game of cat and mouse with her staffers. They were putting pieces of paper in front of the tracker's camera and all this. The tracker was trying to move around. And she kind of looked at the tracker and said, yeah, this tracker stuff is getting out of hand. And I'll remind you that Georgia has some pretty strong anti-stalking laws.
Those are things we don't teach in the classroom, by the way, the anti-stalking techniques. You just have to learn that on the street.
We got to get another break in. We're getting some tweets. I am particularly grateful to Kate Geek, who reminds me it's pronounced politicization. Politicization. Okay, everybody on the same page with that? Sam Burnham tweets, campaign funds quickly becoming California's top export and Georgia's top import. Okay, he's been watching the San Francisco residents for Ossoff spots. Let's get another break out of the way. When we come back, let's do some talking about what happened yesterday when Jeff Sessions came before the Senate Intelligence Committee. But let's also talk about two of Georgia's finest in President Trump's first official cabinet meeting the other day. This is Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air,
please welcome Seth Meyers.
We broadcast Terry's onstage interview with Seth Meyers, host of Late Night with Seth Meyers, former head writer for Saturday Night Live, and host of the news parody Weekend Update. His interview was part of our 30th anniversary celebration. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
We're back. Kerwin Swint and Greg Bluestein are here. I'm Bill Nygut. You know what? Before we talk about yesterday and the testimony of Jeff Sessions, everybody by now has seen video of President Trump holding his first official cabinet meeting and going around the table and asking each of his cabinet members to introduce themselves and then giving them a moment to say whatever comes into their minds. And I just thought it was important to hear. We have two members of this cabinet, mm-hmm. Greg Bluestein, mm-hmm. Tom Price, Secretary of Health and Human Services, and Sonny Perdue, Department Secretary of Agriculture. So let's hear how they responded to the request that they just say whatever comes into their heads. Here's Tom Price.
President, what an incredible honor it is to lead the Department of Health and Human Services at this pivotal time under your leadership. I can't thank you enough for the privilege that you've given me and the leadership that you've shown. It seems like there's an international flair to the messages that are being delivered. I had the opportunity to represent the United States at the G20 Health Summit in Berlin and at the World Health Assembly in Geneva, and I can't tell you how excited and enthusiastic folks are about the United States leadership as it relates to global health security.
And here's Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue.
Good morning, Mr. President. While we're bragging about international travel, I just got back from Mississippi. They love you there. And I want to congratulate you on the men and women you've placed around this table. The holistic team of Working for America is making results in each and every area, working with Secretary Ross and Ambassador Lighthizer and Secretary Mnuchin and Tom Price and Scott Pruitt. This is a team you've assembled that's working hand in glove for the betterment of America. And I want to thank you for that. These are great team members, and we're on your team.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
So the start of this meeting has already been mocked by many, many people, and not just by anti-Trump folks, although certainly they've been the ones who've really found it silly. But let me throw out a theory to you guys and see what you think about this. I wonder to some extent whether this doesn't tell us something about the the mood of the president, his concern about trying to, you know, get out from under the negative poll number. I mean, there's a part of me that wonders if Reince Priebus, the chief of staff, said to each of the cabinet members, this guy needs cheering up. Kerwin?
That could very well be. The old guy needs bucking up. But, you know, also, it's the first official cabinet meeting. They were a little excited, you know. And so, you know, and the cameras are on. They don't want to see anything bad or any detail.
Okay.
My favorite thing out of that was Chris Saliza at CNN ranked them in order of pro-Trump loyalty.
Yeah.
And our two guys got two of the top three slots. Sonny Perdue got third, and Tom Price got second. So for whatever that's worth.
But, you know, this also, Greg, does raise this ongoing question that we in the media have got to try to grapple with all the time. They all talked about how wonderful it is that the president's agenda, he's brave, he's pushing the agenda forward. The president made remarks that have been broadcast broadly about how he's accomplished more than any president other than FDR at this point in his administration. And in fact, we know factually that there hasn't been a single major piece of legislation passed through Congress since he came into office. And it does raise again for us this difficult question. If you report that what the president is saying isn't correct, are you being factual and therefore doing your job appropriately, or are you attacking him?
Yeah, and you're exactly right. There's sort of a prism through which some, not all Republicans by any means, but through some people see saying the truth, telling the truth, saying the fact that there has been no tax reform, there's been no health care overhaul that passed both chambers, no significant piece of landmark legislation that has reached Donald Trump's desk yet, passed by either chamber, and most of it are some of his most significant things were executive orders that have either been tied up in the courts or have not really moved forward yet. That's the truth. That's not some partisan slant on it.
How do you teach this in your political science classes, Kerwin?
Well, like in a media class, we look at the how they present it. You know, I mean, for example, I look at a story on CNN versus Fox News, which is very often the polar opposite of each other. And so they're both reporting facts as they see them, but it's all in the context, the interpretation, the motivation.
Yeah, I thought, okay, and that takes us to Jeff Sessions. Because I thought that a perfect example of what you're saying, Kerwin, is that we know that a good deal of what happened during this hearing yesterday was that Jeff Sessions claimed he couldn't answer the questions being asked about what he and the president said to each other, because he wanted to protect the president's right of executive privilege. Many Democrats pointed out the president had not, in fact, said anything about executive privilege. He invoked executive privilege. And so the question became, is it appropriate? Could he, in fact, fall back on what he said? Sessions said was longstanding policy in justice that allows him not to answer questions about private communications. And Greg, it is no surprise that in the papers this morning and on the cable news networks, there were those who, the conservatives, who said, yes, Jeff Sessions, there have been longstanding policies of this sort, whereas Washington Post and MSNBC said, what's he talking about?
Yeah, and his own Justice Department released documents saying exactly that, that there's longstanding executive branch-wide practice of sort of invoking executive privilege in case the president does that in the future. I think most experts who've been interviewed on this said that it's somewhat of a gray area and it could go either way, but that he could have easily answered those questions.
Well, yeah, that's the problem. He doesn't want to get into details about conversations that who knows where that's going to go. You know, Mueller, the independent counsel, has his investigation at the same time as Congress. And so there are a lot of weeds out there, and they're just being extra cautious, I think.
And one of the most striking exchanges was when Senator, I think it was Ron Wyden, said he was stonewalling. And Sessions said, I'm not stonewalling. I'm just following what the Department of Justice always does.
It is worth pointing out that Eric Holder, when he refused to answer questions in a similar way, was the Congress, the House, I think it was the House. I'd be careful. Mm-hmm. One of the two held him in contempt of Congress.
And I was just going to mention that. I mean, Sessions is on stronger ground when he's talking about the president, a previous attorney general who did much the same thing. And I think Holder was in contempt of Congress. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes. I think that was what they did, and they eventually dropped it.
Yeah.
This has gone the other direction, is the point. What do you think in general of how Sessions handled the questions that Comey made so clear, less than a week earlier?
Well, you know, it's interesting because Sessions asked to come to the Intelligence Committee in open forum, which wasn't planned. And I really think what he wanted to do was confront his accusers, who are many of his former colleagues in the Senate, Democratic colleagues in particular. And I think he did a pretty good job of explaining himself, defending himself in the Russia investigation, made some very strong statements. It was on the question we were just talking about, where it was a little bit more, you know, open-ended about how you think he did.
Yeah, it was one thing to defend himself, which he did. I kind of agree with you. I thought he handled it pretty well. It's another thing when he was asked to speak about and potentially have to defend his president.
Yeah, we were talking about shows of support for Trump earlier at the cabinet meeting. Well, there had been all sorts of reports about rifts between President Trump and his attorney general. Before this hearing, and I think he used a lot of the hearing to showcase that loyalty to Trump, to say he was going to defend Trump, to say that he was, you know, visibly indignant at some of the questions that Democrats were asking him about Trump.
Meanwhile, there's a rather active campaign by some in the Trump circle to throw mud at Robert Mueller. There is a very active effort to undermine his authority, calling into question his relationship with James Comey, I think it's going to be interesting to see at a certain point what the backlash to that is going to look like, Kerwin. I mean, This is a special counsel. He's been appointed by Trump's Justice Department.
Right. Yeah, and I think it was Newt Gingrich who was focusing on the people that Mueller is hiring having contributed to Democrats. But only a week or two ago, the Justice Department was singing Mueller's praises about, you know, his reputation, about how esteemed he is. It sounded very similar to what the original word was on Comey way back when.
Not just the justice, every lawmaker, most of the Georgia delegation, Democrats and Republicans, were talking about what an even-handed guy who's served both parties he is. The New York Times' headline about him right now is, Mueller is safe for now.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing we didn't touch on, which is that we don't know where this – we don't know whether Trump wanted this out, but his one of his closest friends at Newsmax, Chris Ruddy, right, went on TV the other night and said, well, Trump just might fire Robert Mueller. And that caused an outrage.
That tells me right there Trump did want it out, and I think that's how he did it. I think Trump wants these ideas out there. Well, you know, Trump could fire Mueller at any moment, and the fact that he's not just shows you how interested he is in justice. I mean, I think he wants that dichotomy out there.
And how many people have you heard about this so far? We've heard Reince Priebus was about to be fired. We've heard Sessions was about to be fired. We've heard various members of the cabinet. Rex Tillerson was about to be fired.
We never heard that James Comey was going to be fired.
You're right. There's one. But we've heard him sort of float these ideas out. There's going to be a massive staff overhaul, either through his surrogates or sometimes even through him himself. And there's sort of a pins and needles feeling at the White House, it seems.
It's worth saying that the Deputy Attorney General, who's now in charge of the Russia investigation because Jeff Sessions recused himself, Deputy General Rothstein, said in a hearing he was in on the Hill yesterday, he will, as long as I'm dealing with this, his job is safe. And that seems to put it to bed for now, although with President Trump, you never know what side of the bed he's going to wake up on the next morning.
I mean, yeah, he could end up firing Rosenstein and putting in his own deputy, who would be amenable.
Can you say Saturday Night?
That's exactly the analogy.
We have just a couple minutes. I want to touch on another thing that I think has been really interesting to follow this week. Megyn Kelly is suddenly the subject of great controversy because, as you all probably have all read, she decided she would interview Alex Jones for her new TV show on NBC on Sunday nights. Alex Jones, of course, among other things, is the guy behind InfoWars, Kerwin, notoriously slash and burn right-wing journalism, and their sponsors pulling out of the show, saying there's no place for this guy to be treated with respect by Megyn Kelly or others. What do you think about all that?
Well, I mean, this guy is radioactive, and the reaction is that this is not somebody you want to give primetime air to. I think Megyn Kelly and NBC believe they're being provocative and trying to shed light on maybe how this guy is not someone who you should put much credence into. But just the mere fact they're putting him on the air, and then when the advertisers start to pull out, you know you've got a problem.
And their argument is that this guy... it has the ear of the president. The president has, I think, retweeted or at least echoed some of the arguments Alex Jones has made about illegal voters. And I think InfoWars was given White House credentials and that he's sort of emblematic of a right-wing media outlet that Trump is listening to. But I still get nervous whenever you give airtime to someone like that.
Then that's another media question. Yeah. One of our panelists last week quoted from InfoWars. And my feeling when I heard it was, well, that's a perspective. I think our listeners maybe need to hear what a segment of the voting public is responding to, reading, and thinking about. But there are questions at what point you don't give them attention.
Now, Megyn Kelly's response was she wanted to shine a light on it, right?
The other thing that troubles me about that is when sponsors start pulling out of things. You know, it used to be in the Channel 2 newsroom years ago, the ratings book and the news morning news meetings never, ever came in contact with one another. Now, the meetings start with a recitation at all TV stations, basically, a recitation of what the numbers from the previous night
and
show.
And with us,
like.
Metrics are unfathomably more important than they used to be for print journalists and digital journalists as well. But it also goes to what we were talking about earlier, Julius Caesar. Same thing is happening. Sponsors are pulling out. You're seeing sponsors pull out of Megyn Kelly's show because of the content, not because of anything she did. Like Bill O'Reilly, and not because of any sort of allegations about her conduct, but because of the content. That worries me as a journalist.
All right, to close the loop on that, if a sponsor can start dictating editorial content, even as offensive as the content might be, are we opening up a whole new can of worms that all of us who believe in the First Amendment ought to think about? So, just food for thought, listeners. We're out of time today. Kerwin Swint, thank you so much for making the drive from Kennesaw to be with. How's our friend Sam Olens doing up there?
He's doing great.
I bet he is.
He's settling in. He's a great guy.
And so glad to be out of partisan politics. Greg Bluestein, you're going to be busy for the next few days.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait till next Wednesday.
Yeah. Do you want to say a quick hello to your wife and children?
Hi, wife, children, and mom, who I'm sure is listening right now.
Because they're not going to see a whole lot of you in the week ahead. I'm Bill Nygut. We are out of time for today's show. We'll be back with you on Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock. And I hope you can join us then. You can subscribe to the podcast, the Political Rewind podcast, on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast from. And it'll be on the AJC's Political Insider blog at some point in the next few hours if you want to listen there. I want to remind you one time again, starting on July 6th, you're going to hear us on the air on Thursdays, not just Monday, Wednesday, Friday with Political Rewind, but on Thursdays at 2 o'clock, we're going to begin a weekday version of Two-Way Street, our show that features authors, artists, performers, chefs, scientists, creative people with interesting stories to tell. So we're excited about coming to the weekday lineup, and I hope you'll join us for that. That's it. We'll see you again on Friday at 3.